courtroom, thank you. Okay, for the record, the next case on the call is Anderson versus A&R Ag Spraying and so forth. Chief Justice Heviken is recused. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
This case presents the question of whether in the course of evaluating and appraising the stock in a small, closely held corporation, the district court may ignore a $1.1 million debt which this corporation carries on the theory that, and I'm quoting from his opinion, it doesn't all have to be paid on the same day.
Doesn't matter which valuation process you consider and take into that debt, such as the asset versus the income versus market?
Well, we hired an expert. Her name was Janet Lobbins from up in Lincoln. I think she's been mentioned in opinions here several times. And Ms. Lobbins used a method which is, I think, generally characterized as EBITDA, E-B-I-T-D-A, which would be income before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And
so that's
there
the
was
income
an expert
approach
for the other side, and that expert used several theories, none of which I find are recognized by most of the authorities, and I don't know whether she ever did come up with a valuation.
Well, the court found that she did. Didn't
well, I
the
think
court?
The court was very critical of her credibility.
In the court's order, didn't the court determine an evaluation based on income for each of the two experts and then split the difference?
Well, that's what he did, but he was very critical of the expert witness that was called by the plaintiff. First of all, the plaintiff disclosed this expert early on. We deposed this expert. She had a theory which was roughly the same theory as our expert had. Then, after the close of discovery, she changed that. Then there was an interruption in the trial and she changed it again. And by the time we got back to the trial, she had, I guess, would have to be called her third theory, which she presented to the court a range of values, which
but the court didn't rely upon that.
What?
The court didn't rely upon her range of values.
Oh, that's right. Said that it was confusing and of very little help to him.
Well, that referenced the asset approach, didn't it?
Well, I
she gave a range.
Know if you can even say it was the asset approach. It was pretty wild. And it changed all the time. And I can't analyze that and tell you what it was. I mean, it used an asset approach, all right, but in part, but there was a flaw in that, a really basic flaw. First of all,
the court didn't accept her analysis for the asset approach. I mean, is that correct? The court.
Well, I don't know if he accepted it or not, but by the time she testified, it had changed.
Well, he hadn't relied
it wasn't
on
the
it.
Asset. I'm sorry, go ahead.
In his order, doesn't he reference two specific values based on the income approach, one value for your expert and one value for the plaintiff's expert, and determine those are the values that he was considering, and then he split the difference? Isn't that what he did? Is that what he relied upon?
Well, yes, I think he did that.
Well, he finds, he says, says X says 654 and Y says 624, which is 30, and he adds 15 to the bottom number. Isn't that what Justice Funk's question is? Isn't that how the judge performed
I think,
so therefore accepted those numbers?
I think he did that, but I think our brief sets out the several instances in his opinion in which he was very critical of the approach of the plaintiff's expert witness, and I want to get to this point about the plaintiff's expert witness. We had a date. The statute fixes your date. The date upon which the valuation must be determined. And it's tied to the date that you file your complaint, okay? In this case, it was April 5th, 2017, and kind of by agreement, although there was nothing formal on the record, we went back to March 31st, because March 31st was the end of a quarter, and that simplified the arithmetic. And they
were on a cash basis? This company was on a cash basis?
Yes, they were, strictly cash.
Thank you.
And...
But I meant a cash basis as opposed to accrual. They were on a cash basis for accounting purposes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So instead of taking that date, the plaintiff went back to a property statement that had been given by the corporation or that had been completed by the corporation's bank on behalf of the corporation so that there'd be a record for the banking examiners to see. And they took that as their starting point. And then they added and subtracted from that by opinions of their experts, some of which involved the valuation of equipment. And there was no evidence at all whatsoever to show that she had any knowledge of the valuation of equipment. We hired a guy. He went out and did an appraisal. We hired one of the stocks, and they sell property of all kinds all the time up in our area. And stock appraised all of this as of the date we gave him, which was March 31st of 2017.
For the income approach, do you use the values of the equipment?
No, sir, Your Honor. We had the equipment appraised.
Correct.
But so, the expert used the EBITDA approach, which was an income, stream of income approach, adjusted for 2% growth and...
That's based on how much income is received and how many expenses are paid by the corporation, what the tax returns show, what the balance sheets show, the profit and loss. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
Does the methodology used by your expert count debt twice?
Count debt twice?
Correct.
No, I don't think it does. No, she didn't do that. She came up with an income, and then she determined the value of the stock based upon the income, and then she said when you deduct the debt, this thing isn't worth anything.
But is the income considered debt service payments? Is debt service payments factored into the income?
Well, not on your tax return, they wouldn't. I mean, you have to service your debt. Yeah, you have to pay it. You can deduct the interest, and we know what the interest was. There was about $23,000 worth of interest that was owed, and that had to be taken into account.
Did your expert use any number or value to determine how much the company would expend for equipment on an annual basis? Was that around $70,000?
Yeah, 70,000. That's the number that she used.
So you'd have,
and actually, so did their expert use that same number.
So for expenses, you'd have $70,000 to pay for equipment during the year. Plus, you'd have the interest expense. So that would be $93,000 expense per year that you'd subtract from the income. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That should give you then a profit or loss per year. Correct.
Correct. That's right.
So then what authority is there to subtract the entire amount of debt that's owed from those values when you're using the income approach?
I would suggest that's the general accounting principles. And, it's like this. Any divorce case which is tried in any Nebraska court, you run into a home, which has to have a value, which is done by an appraiser, and then you run into a mortgage.
Sounds like an asset approach to me, isn't that?
Well,
the value of the home less the debt?
Let me finish my example. So what do you do with that mortgage? That's a debt. You subtract that from the value of the home. In this case, we're valuing the stock of a corporation, a closely held small corporation, and its assets are trucks. And
Counsel, before your time runs out, I would like to talk to you about a couple of the assignments of errors that you have. The issue of the judgment against the corporation.
Yes, well, the corporation didn't ask for anything, so I don't see how.
Did the court have any authority, statutory authority, to order judgment against the corporation?
No, none. If you follow that statute, the shareholder, which is my client, Mike, cannot elect to purchase the shares in the corporation unless the corporation does not elect. And the corporation did not elect to purchase those shares. So then, for some reason or other, the court entered judgment both against Mike for the value of the shares, but also the corporation. And then they swooped in and took $100,000 out of the corporate's account on a garnishment. And that record is here because we applied to this court for a stay of the judgment till we could get that issue presented to this court.
But there was no supersedious bond filed, is that?
Well, there was no supersedious bond because Mike didn't think that he had anything that was exposed that they would be able to levy on while he was taking an appeal. But then when he enters judgment against the corporation too, there's an in and out flow of money through an account in the bank at Plainview, and they garnished that and put us in a really bad position because there was a time there when we didn't know whether or not we were going to be able to meet payroll, which would have terminated this corporation. The drivers like to get paid. So that issue, I don't know how the court missed that issue, but we never requested a judgment or made an election on behalf of the corporation to purchase this minority interest.
Mr. Moyer, unless the members of the court have other questions, your time is up. Thank you.
No, I see that. It usually is about now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Kathleen Rocky, and I represent the appellee in this case, Cheryl Anderson. Mrs. Anderson is the widow of Randy Anderson, and Randy Anderson and Mike Rayford formed A&R Ag Spraying and Trucking about 20 years ago. This is a great case to argue to law students.
And given that we're talking to law students, perhaps you could begin by explaining the standard of review.
Well, I think the standard of review in this case, Your Honor, is a de novo review. The Supreme Court gives weight to the lower court's assessment of the credibility of the witnesses. And in this particular case, the reason I think it's so important for law students to hear a case like this is because of some of the many mistakes that were made along the way as these people tried to establish their business and run it. Randy Anderson and Mike Rayford did one thing. They went to a lawyer, they filed articles of incorporation, and they thought they were done. And they clearly were not, or at least they should have done it in a different way. When Randy Anderson died, there was no buy-sell agreement. There was no stock register, there were no corporate meetings held, there were no minutes maintained. And so the main remedy that Cheryl Anderson had was to petition to the court to dissolve the corporate entity. Interestingly enough, the corporation had taken the step of purchasing a life insurance policy on Randy Anderson's life, but the beneficiary was Mike Rayford, not the corporation, not Cheryl Anderson, nothing that would assist Mrs. Anderson in this situation.
From a statutory standpoint then, what was the first thing that happened?
Well, the first thing that happened was she had to open an estate, and local attorney Jeffrey Hirota was appointed as the personal representative of the estate. After the estate was opened, a meeting was called by Mr. Rayford's attorney to try to see if there could be some sort of new bylaws entered into by the parties, by the personal representative and Mr. Rayford.
So there was some unsuccessful negotiations prior to the lawsuit for seeking the dissolution.
Yes, yeah. Well, I was just going to make the point that there was a deadlock declared or determined at that point, and thereafter the estate was concluded with the stock being distributed to Mrs. Anderson by the personal representative, and then she filed this action as, at that point, the 50% shareholder.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, so when we filed that action at that point.
That was an action to dissolve the corporation?
This was an action initially to dissolve the corporation and to raise issues concerning some of the improprieties on the part of Mr. Rayford and how he had managed the corporate entity, how he had spent some of the funds, how he had dissipated some of the assets.
And from a procedural standpoint, then how does his effort to election to purchase get into the lawsuit?
Well, the election to purchase happens after this corporate dissolution action is filed. Then he submitted, and it was, I agree, as Mr. Moyer stated, only his election. There
wasn't a similar
one.
Was it resisted?
It was not resisted. At that point in time, the parties were ordered to and did participate in mediation. That mediation was not successful. We then notified the court because the case was on the docket. It remained pending while the court asked us to attend mediation. And when that was not successful, we asked the court to enter a pretrial order and proceed to get a scheduling order and get the case set for trial. So when the trial came, both parties had came to the court with experts. It was truly a battle of the experts in determining which appropriate valuation method should be adopted by the court. And as the court was told by both experts, there's the asset method, as has been mentioned, the income approach and the market approach. Both agreed the market approach wasn't appropriate. Both experts did opine about the income approach. Our expert on the last day of trial did testify about the court adopting the asset approach. That was rejected by the court, and the court ultimately circled back to looking at the two experts' analysis based on the income approach. And as has been noted, the court basically developed a number between those two numbers in exercising its equitable powers and exercising its equitable jurisdiction to determine a value here in this case.
Did the court err in doing that?
We accept the court's decision. It wasn't exactly what we wanted. We hoped that the court would adopt the asset approach, but we knew the income approach was a viable means by which this company could be valued. We knew the income approach had some validity as a recognized means by which to value a company of this type. So we were not here today to challenge that number and insist that this court go back to the asset approach number our expert testified to.
So how should debt be treated then in the income approach?
Well, I think as we noted in our brief, what the court did was it basically said it looked at the income approach, it looked at the experts' opinions of the income approach, and it determined that this real issue, as is noted in the brief of the appellant, boiled down to this adding back in this, or subtracting out, rather, the significant debt that the company had. And I think the judge was concerned that there was very little, if any, evidence that substantiated the argument made by Ms. Levens that should be used in its entirety, particularly since this was being valued at a fair value, that is a term of art that we see in these cases, and as a going concern. And I think the court's concern was that if you added all that value of that debt back into the mix, this created a corporation with a negative value of nearly $500,000, and that was totally, that really made no sense to Judge Kuby. That we would do that, particularly where there was no rational basis given for adding all that debt in substantially gutting the value of the company. Particularly
counsel, under the income approach, and I haven't studied the Bill of Exception, but the experts attempt to characterize what the income is and then use some sort of capitalization to reach a valuation.
Right.
How did the experts differ on the capitalization technique?
I think ultimately when they came down to it, I don't think there was that much of a difference there. I know there was an adjusted book value asset method approach utilized by Ms. Pofahl, and her number was greater, but I think their capitalization rates were somewhat similar. And in so doing, in looking at those two experts' opinions, the court did what so many courts do, which is basically takes what it thinks is viable or valid from both sides, perhaps, and tries to develop its own number, which it's permitted to do, because it is not required to accept one opinion over the other. And particularly here, where we were looking at the value of this business as a going concern. I think it was clear that the company was able to service its debt. It didn't even have an operating note. It had debt, which was for the various equipment items for the spraying and trucking aspect of the company. But the judge, Judge Kubi, was very careful even in developing the value that he did by taking into consideration the need to service that debt and the need to take that into consideration in arriving again at that fair value that we believe he ultimately came to.
Could you address the propriety of the judgment against the corporation?
Yeah, that's really a typical thing to address. I have to admit, as I did, that there was no election to purchase filed by the corporation. The corporation, as was, and Mr. Rafert were both represented by the same attorney. We do know the corporation was at deadlock. There was no doubt that it was. We had two, on paper, 50% shareholders who couldn't agree on anything, including bylaws to try to enter into following the death of Mr. Anderson. And so it's really a, I would say, an unusual situation in that respect. But I think what the court did was, I think it determined that out of, it may be as a matter of equity, that that's the manner in which the judgment should be entered. But I have to concede, there was only one election to purchase, and that was filed by Mr. Moyer on behalf of Mr. Rafert,
on behalf of the corporation. Any statutory basis in the corporate dissolution statutes for the judgment against the corporation?
I think in the Model Business Corporation Act, I couldn't see anything there that specifically addressed that issue.
How would you characterize the award of vehicles to your client?
I think it was very reasonable under the circumstances. Those vehicles were not being used in the day-to-day operations of the company. They had been kept by Mrs. Anderson in her possession while the case has been pending after her husband died. They were assets that the company had long allowed Randy Anderson to use during his lifetime. And it was really, it was sort of a situation where there was no tremendous hardship or burden placed upon the company by allowing that to go to Mrs. Anderson in payment of her fees and expenses. It was an unusual decision, but there's nothing in the act that precluded the court from making that determination that that was an equitable way to handle it.
Do you understand it to be fees and expenses?
I understood it to be in lieu of fees and expenses, recognizing that she did have legitimate fees and expenses that she had to pay to file this lawsuit and deal with the litigation expenses.
What evidence is in our record of her fees and expenses?
We filed a statement of costs, and we also had her testify, as did the expert, Ms. Popal, testify about fees associated with her work in this case.
Is there any correlation between those evidence of correlation between those fees and expenses and the value of the vehicle?
In the appraisal, I believe there are values of both of those vehicles set forth therein.
Is there a correlation between those values and the fees and expenses?
I would say they probably are pretty similar. I'm not going to say they're exactly the same because I can't tell you that for sure.
So the authority with respect to the vehicles, you all have been living with this case, are better at this statute, was 21-201E.
Correct. That's the citation.
That's the statutory basis.
Right.
The award of the vehicle.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. There's no time for a rebuttal. Is that correct? Thank you very much. Lawyers are excused. Thank you very much. So, We're a courtroom till we're not a courtroom, and we're not going to be a courtroom precisely in a moment. And if there are other lawyers in the gallery who wish to excuse themselves, that's fine too. The chief will rejoin the court, and then we will do some questions and answers from the students. Thank you.